thank you once again for the invitation to be here. It's great to see all of you tonight. And greetings from Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm sure we'll have a great conversation tonight. On April 2nd, 1865, Lieutenant General A.P. Hill, in command of the 3rd Corps of the Army of Northern Virginia, was killed instantly by a shot from Corporal John W. Mock of the 138th Pennsylvania Regiment outside Petersburg, Virginia. Hill was performing a reconnaissance on the Confederate right after the Federals had succeeded in breaking through the southern lines that morning. Mock's .58 caliber ball struck Hill in the left hand and then through the heart, spinning him around in his saddle before he fell sprawled on the ground next to his horse. He was dead before he hit the ground. Ambrose Powell Hill had served as Corps Commander in the Army of Northern Virginia since the spring of 1863, being promoted by Robert E. Lee to that command just before launching the Gettysburg Campaign that culminated in the great battle that was fought at Gettysburg from July 1st through 3rd of 1863. At the time of Hill's death, Lee's army was faced with complete collapse. He ordered the evacuation of Petersburg the night Hill was killed and surrendered to General U.S. Grant a week later at Appomattox Courthouse on April 9th. The Civil War was all but over. In his biography of A.P. Hill, historian James I. Robertson related the bizarre and unique story of how the general was buried in 3 separate locations between 1865 and 1891. On the day Hill was killed, members of his staff rushed to secure his body from where it lay and deliver it to his wife, Kitty. By that afternoon, Kitty and her 2 daughters, along with Captain Frank Hill, who was nephew to the general, were accompanying the body to Richmond for burial at Hollywood Cemetery. They could not get to the cemetery because people were fleeing Richmond before the expected advance and occupation of the city by the occupying Union forces. Since they were unable to bury the body in Hollywood Cemetery, their second plan was to take it to Fairview Cemetery in Culpeper, where Hill's parents and other family were buried. But by then, the day was warm, and they could not make the 100-mile trip to Culpeper before the body began to decompose. The family then made the hasty decision to bury the general in Chesterfield County in the Winston Family Cemetery. And so on April 4th, the body was laid to rest there in a temporary unmarked grave until they could bring it to Culpeper at a more opportune time. 2 years later, a group of veterans proposed the transferal of Hill's body to Hollywood Cemetery outside of Richmond, which was the family's original desire. Prominent friends led the effort, persuaded the family to allow for the remains exhumation and interment in Hollywood. Hill's body was exhumed from the Winston Cemetery to the relief of Hill's family. A grave site was secured at Lot N35 in Hollywood, and his body was laid to rest there, but yet with no tombstone. All that marked the grave was an inscription in the curb with the words, Lieutenant General A.P. Hill. After Robert E. Lee died in 1870, Confederate memorials began appearing all over the South. In 1887, the Pegram Battalion Association began work on formally proposing a Hill statue in Richmond. But Hill's memorial would be distinct from the others. Unlike the other memorials in the city, Hill's would serve as his final resting place. There was still no headstone or marker in Hollywood of any kind, except for the crude inscription on the curb. So with the support and funding of former Hill staff, the project went forward. A Richmond real estate company donated land at the intersection of Laburnum Avenue and Hermitage Road for the memorial site. The memorial was comprised of a 6-foot base with a 24-foot pedestal topped with an 8-foot statue of the general. And under the base was a vault to receive Hill's remains, which had been in the soil of Hollywood Cemetery for 20 years. On July 1st, a group of veterans arrived to exhume Hill from his grave at Hollywood. His remains were found, and that evening, Hill was buried for a third time under the base of the unconstructed memorial without ceremony or religious ritual. On May 30th, 1892, the memorial to A.P. Hill was dedicated. 15,000 people came, and there the memorial stood until December 12th, 2022. After the death of George Floyd in 2020, protesters demanded the removal of statues, markers, memorials to the Confederacy and all those who fought for it. In Richmond, protesters pulled down the memorial to Jefferson Davis, and city officials in June 2020 ordered the removal of statues of Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart and others that had stood on Monument Avenue and other sites around Richmond. But removing the Hill statue was more complicated because for about 130 years, it served as his grave. It took two more years of legal wrangling, but finally the statue was removed and given to the Black History Museum and Cultural Center of Virginia. Hill's remains, unearthed for the third time, were brought to Fairview Cemetery in Culpeper for his fourth funeral. Now, what does this strange set of occurrences tell us? Probably a lot of things, but one unmistakable insight we get from the story of A.P. Hill's body is that history is basic to our humanity. Over a century after his interment, under the pedestal that memorialized him, people continue to care deeply about Hill's legacy, the legacy of the Civil War, and all that followed in its wake. Even while the body was being taken out from the base of the memorial, there was contention among the onlookers between a Confederate sympathizer and an African-American man offended by the sight of a Confederate flag. Political ideologies do not determine the relevance and significance of history to persons. But conservative people have a special interest in history because they are especially oriented to the past and are disposed to revere tradition. Now, I've been teaching history since 1992. I've taught from third grade all the way to the PhD level. In that time, I've taught students history classes and seminars, church basements, single-wide trailers, maximum security prison, on stately university and seminary campuses. I've always been struck by the fact that for many students, history consists of little more than an irrelevant litany of dates, names, obscure places on a map. I try to teach students that historical consciousness is basic to our human nature. Every person has a stake in how the past is interpreted for its meaning, even if we don't understand it, or even if we don't appreciate it. The story of A.P. Hill's bones is an example of the significance and deep relevance of history to every one of us. Consider that human persons are the only living creatures who possess consciousness of the past, the present, and the future. I have a couple cats. We have a couple of cats in our house. Their names are Alan and Jackpot. They are creatures of habit, you know? Creatures of habit. They move around. They live and breathe and have their being in patterns. And as wonderful as they are, they don't have any concept of the past, present, and future. They don't have any ability to understand, evaluate, or benefit from knowledge or wisdom gained from their experiences in the past for the sake of the present. And they have no conception of their future for their hopes. They don't have any hopes. They don't have any anxieties. They don't have any aspirations. They're cats. Historical consciousness is a salient feature of our bearing the image of God, who is over time. He's the creator of time. He's active within time. And he instilled historical consciousness in persons who he granted the image of God. He created a consciousness of our position in time, wisdom and understanding, the formation of our conscience. These are the benefits of historical consciousness, and they're possible for human persons alone. Now, our consideration of the past is part of our pursuit of truth. Because of this, virtue is necessary if we hope to arrive intentionally at coherent and meaningful truth. Virtue is also necessary because it helps us morally evaluate tradition. Not all traditions are worth keeping. And virtue gives us guidance on how to wisely choose which traditions to conserve. Lastly, the pursuit of truth and virtue offer rewards to their pursuers. The virtuous pursuit of truth in history both reveals truth and inculcates virtue. We don't gain the whole truth from a God's eye perspective in the same way we do not gain virtue to the extent we become morally blameless. But the extent of our gain does not necessarily indicate the quality of the gain. We gain actual truth and we gain actual virtue in our historical pursuit when that pursuit is virtuous. To sum up, the study of history makes one mature. The pursuit of virtue and the pursuit of truth are both aspirational, and they are equally necessary in making sense of the past and responsibly guarding tradition in preparation for handing it down to future generations. Now, what is history? What is the purpose of history? And what are the limits of our historical knowledge? These are serious questions that have no simple answers that will satisfy every one of us. But still, we do have reliable guides to help us as we think about how to answer these questions. Historian Alan Gelzo referred to history as an answer to the second question. He meant by this that the most basic human question that we all ask, the first question, to satisfy the most elemental curiosity in the mind is this: what is that? So the second question, Gelzo's historian's question, is where did it come from? Since antiquity, persons have relied upon epic poetry, lists, annals, to answer the second question. But all of which represent early methods of making sense of the past, but none of which are really history. History, the Greek root word is historia, which means inquiry or research, was introduced by Herodotus, who died in the 5th century BC. History has been the primary way we've asked and answered the second question since the 5th century. And Gelzo's really elegant style of framing an understanding of what is essential to history accentuates the reality that the search for historical knowledge is really basic to us. Another historian, John Lukacs, described history as the remembered past. What he meant was that persons alone among living creatures possess both a conscious and unconscious awareness of the past. Thinking historically occurs when persons work to construct narratives that make sense of the past in realistic terms. And that is, they seek to offer an account of the past that comports with reality, not with fiction, and not with allegory. So Lukacs describes the historical project as this: a striving for truth even more than for justice. So historians work to understand and represent real persons and real events in past time. And collective self-knowledge came to be understood by Western moderns as linked to knowledge of history. Richard Weaver, an intellectual historian and professor of English at the University of Chicago in the mid-20th century, he thought of history in similar terms as Lukacs. He expressed concern that modern Americans were prone to ignore history, and in doing so, lose a key aspect of their humanity. Historical thinking consists in reflection on the past, and the past is the source of all the knowledge we possess. Weaver conceived of the present as a thin line. Think of the present as a thin line. It's ever advancing along with the passage of time. Every second of time that we are inhabiting, what we know of as now, is becoming the past with the inexorable ticking away of those seconds. Sorry to say this, but you're all getting older. Contrasted with the present, the future, Weaver said, is really just a composite of images that we have in our minds of the past. that we display in the theater of our minds. So take, for example, when I imagine my children and what they'll be like in 5 years, I'm taking images of them from my memory and casting those images and their present character traits in terms of what I imagine them to be as older versions of themselves that they are now. And in imagining their futures, I have really nothing else to go on except for their past. Here's how Weaver described past, present, and future. He said, the present is a line without any width. The future, only a screen in our minds on which we project combinations of memory. Present knowledge is ephemeral. Future knowledge is conditional. But past knowledge, limited though it may be, is real. And since it's real, it has substantive bearing on how we live in the present. Weaver referred to the realistic, substantive remembrance of the past as piety. As we remember the people of the past as real and living in a world that was also real as we are now, we take them on their own terms. And when we do, we gain wisdom for our lives and for our futures. But in contrast, Weaver wrote of our proneness to turn away from the past, the impiety of those who would intentionally reject the past begets vain utopianism that would seek to rid society of all tradition and order that have served us well in favor of a dreamy new order based on not much more than sentimentality at worst and abstract deductions at best. Revolutionaries on the left and counter-revolutionaries on the right seek to upend tradition in society by fancying utopian, unrealistic whimsy rather than learning from concrete realities observable in past time. Weaver rightly argued that the purpose of historical thought is the formation of the conscience. He understood that the conscience as memory that guides us towards proper action. History is therefore of profound epistemological and moral importance. History is not so objective that one can look at the Holocaust and see it merely as an event alongside other events occurring in the 20th century. It was that, but it was much more. We know that instinctively. It was a moral event. It had relevance for the whole human race from the 1930s and 40s all the way to today. And as we in the present reflect on that event, we remember that persons are still morally fallible. And the oft-repeated slogan of never again is nothing more than a sentimental pipe dream if we abandon historical reflection that's aimed at the truth and formation of the conscience. Lukács said it like this: the purpose of history is understanding even more than accuracy. What he meant by that was the necessity of historical accuracy is a given. But history is far more than just a quest for accuracy. It's the pursuit of knowledge, the pursuit of understanding, without which life is not worth living at all. And it's important to acknowledge here that knowledge we have of the past, while real, is limited. Making sense of the past is kind of like drawing a map. There are many kinds of maps: political maps, topographical maps, physical maps, road maps, nautical charts, for those of you sailors and maritime people. A road map, even when it's accurate, will not capture every detail of a region. We all have road maps on our phones and we use them all the time. Think about a road map. It's accurate, but it doesn't capture everything about a region. It'll leave certain things out to emphasize the position of roads in relation to cities, intersections, places of interest, things like that. We would not say that a road map is wrong because it did not include the physical features of the topography, nor would we say that a physical map is wrong because it didn't include county boundaries. And similarly, history, for example, of the Hoover presidency, will be written from the perspective of a particular author and will cover the details based on the choices that that author makes. But those choices don't in themselves determine the accuracy of the author's claims. but they do reflect his goals or methods and sources employed by the historian. A history of a period is like a map. It'll include the details that the author chose to represent, but it will not include every detail that occurred in the past. That's not possible. The past is gone. It's not our task to get it back. We're not like Doc Brown in Back to the Future, you know, building a time machine out of a quirky car to take us back to 1955 at 88 miles an hour. I mean, I don't even really want to go back to 1955 anyway. If we could go back in time, we might be able to understand by experience what it would be like to live in the past, like, say, 14th century England. But we would lack the perspective we have now in historical reflecting on that period. Thinking historically is better than going back in time if our purpose is to actually understand the past. The perspective we have in the present gives us a field of vision over the past that allows us to represent any particular life or event or idea in its context in a more complete way than if we were there. Think of historical thinking like standing on a high mountain, looking out over a broad landscape. We've all stood in high places. You've been to mountains. You've been to tall buildings, looking out over the view. When we think historically, we're taking a vast surface area of times and places and lives and events and ideas. We see the past from a high perspective that no one living in any given moment could ever have had. And the effect of that perspective can be really thrilling. I wrote a biography of John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State. And I was struck by the fact when I wrote that biography that I could know how any given dilemma that he faced in his lifespan — he was born in 1888, he died in 1959. Any dilemma that he faced, any problem that he faced, at any point in his life, I knew how it was going to pan out for him. I knew how it was going to be resolved. Even though he could never have had that kind of knowledge in the moment. We know that, for example, Dulles, his attitude towards war and peace, his attitudes about nationalism, his attitudes about diplomacy, would undergo great change, 1930s, 40s, 50s. And we know the reasons for many of those changes. His changing attitudes mystified many of those closest to him, and he seemed to be hardly aware of those changes. The Dulles of 1944 was very different from the Dulles of 1954. Now, from our vantage point in the present, we can look back on Dulles' entire lifespan from the frigid day that he was born at his grandparents' house in Washington, D.C., all the way to the bright spring day they buried him in Arlington Cemetery. To some extent, we can see the end from the beginning in this particular man's life. And that's one of the profoundly consequential realities of historical thinking. How would you treat people in your life? Or how would you handle your life's joys and dilemmas and problems if you knew the day and the manner of your death? Would you even want to have such knowledge? As his biographer, I had that kind of knowledge of Dulles' whole mortal existence. That's power. Power. And the power can be also pernicious. The illusion that historical perspective results in agency over the past can lead to idolatry of self over the dead. Historical perspective tempts us to go beyond merely understanding to embrace delusions of grandeur. We may have an embarrassment of riches, for example, of artifacts in an archival collection, but who can discern the motives and thoughts of the human heart? Perspective tempts us to use our knowledge to justify ourselves in our ideological commitments to the exclusion of other possible interpretations of what we might object to. We often cherry pick from the historical record the evidence that backs up our preconceived ideologies while ignoring evidence that undermines those ideologies. We dare not succumb to the temptation presented by that illusion of omniscience. As soon as we think we have a person figured out or an event all nailed down, we may be surprised to discover we were just wrong. Dulles is a case in point, He was a simple man. He appeared to be a simple man to his contemporaries, even some of his biographers, but the reality was a lot more complicated. He was a man full of paradoxes, just like you, just like me. He was very complex. The knowledge we gain from perspective is a gift, but it comes with responsibility. I could take the span of Dulles' life and times, the perspective that came with a simple yet momentous duty. I had to represent him with justice if I wanted to rightly pursue truth about his life and times. The historian's task is to employ justice to the dead before thinking of applying justice through history to the present. Some contemporary historians style themselves activist historians. If a historian sees his task primarily as social activism, then the tendency to do injustice to the dead is hard to resist. Activist history doesn't foster humility in the pursuit of truth, but it's tailor-made to mine the useful material from the past and ignore material that doesn't fit so well with a preconceived narrative. Employing justice historically must begin with the past subject matter and then proceed to the present audience. Then justice has a chance of obtaining for the good of the present and with faithfulness to the past. While Lukács argued that the purpose of history was understanding, and Weaver wrote that it was for conscious formation, another historian I want to bring up to you, Cold War historian John Lewis Gaddis, said that history grows us up into maturity. Each of these three historians' understandings of what history aims for is right. Gaddis said, "We understand how much has preceded us and how unimportant we are in relation to it. Such understanding causes us to learn our place and to feel small as we stand over the temporal precipice and consider how deep and all-consuming the past is, not only to the dead, but to one day to ourselves also. The dead still speak. They say to us, 'As you are now, I once was. And as I am, you one day will be.'" Our personal and communal identities are important, but those identities make us the center of reality. Obsession with personal or group identity, so common in today's culture, is a marker of childishness. We aim for a realistic assessment of identity which offers wisdom. The way we see history ought to humble us and cause us to stand in wonder rather than cynicism. But we often fool ourselves into thinking history is defined by a plot line like that in Star Wars. History becomes a simple affair of identifying who is evil and who is pure, who's on the wrong side of history and who's on the right side of history. Or our understanding of history may be deep, but how we deploy that understanding for present purposes can be puerile, selfish, and dishonest. Do we not herein find the essence of human nature? Persons bear the image of God. They possess profound and invaluable dignity. But persons are also fallible, myopic, sinful, and selfish. Our freedom and knowledge bless us with great privileges. But with the enjoyment of those privileges comes immense responsibility. All these considerations as to the meaning and purpose of history relate to nature. As persons, we possess historical consciousness. We're responsible for both the act and the method of employing that consciousness. So, historical thinking requires virtue, if historical thinking consists in the pursuit of truth. Specifically, the virtues of prudence, charity, patience, and courage are fitting for historical thinking. Guided by virtue, the study of history is ennobling. Historical thinking both heightens our dignity as persons and chastens us in our predisposition to hubris. A virtue-less pursuit of truth in history is counterfeit and futile. But a virtuous pursuit of truth in history is informed by humility before truth itself. We hold in tension the understanding that, in the immediate sense, our access to historical truth is limited. But in the end, we're subject to the authority of truth. We don't get to just make up the past as we go along, according to what suits us. Now, most of us, I'm just looking around the room, most of us probably center right people. Maybe there's some people in here that are center left, but no matter what your political views are, your ideology is, let me just ask this question. What do conservatives seek to conserve? Conservatives conserve tradition. The past is the fount of tradition. How we make sense of the past determines of the value we place on tradition. When we employ prudence, we see that some traditions are worthy of conservation, but other traditions are not. Aspirational conservatives know that change is not to be eschewed. Change ought to be managed intentionally, deliberately, procedurally, all the while looking to the guiding light of tradition. In this, aspirational conservatives revere tradition, but avoid traditionalism. That is, turning tradition per se into some kind of absolute normative authority. Another historian I really love, Peter Viereck, he said, "The conservative conserves discriminately, the reactionary indiscriminately." By reactionary, he means a far right person, someone on the far right. By this, he meant that while all conservatives revere tradition, rightist, far-right reactionaries accept all tradition without any critical thought. Rightly understood, tradition, according to Viereck, meant all the lessons of the past, but only the ethically acceptable events. In other words, we conserve the traditions emerging from events that represent the best of human nature and human achievement. And as to the painful episodes in the past, we repudiate the wrongs done and abandon traditions that preserve those wrongs, but we still maintain the memory of those episodes. Even the frightful events in the past give us truths by which to live. In contrast, the right-wing reactionary discerns no ethical nuances at all in tradition. In nostalgically holding on to the past, the reactionary whitewashes past sins, and thus, as Viereck said, he misses all the lessons. Now, some traditions are impractical, and some are immoral. Such traditions can and should be abandoned. Progressives may think of all conservatives as despising change and holding to tradition as absolute authority, as in, we've always done it this way, so we have to continue as we've always done it. But consider how a conservative might challenge this idea by critically assessing certain traditions while revering tradition as a category. Tradition, broadly speaking, can be carefully pruned and stewarded, prepared for bequeathal to new generations. For example, horses. Y'all like horses? Any horse people in here? Okay, got some horse people in here. Horses were once ubiquitous, used for all modes of land transportation, communication for millennia. The Botai people, people, they were in present-day Kazakhstan. They were the first to domesticate horses in the 4th millennium B.C. Horses were used for personal transportation, transportation of goods. They were used by armies for reconnaissance, hauling weapons and supplies, and used as cavalry. They were indispensable for plowing. The invention of the stirrup was in the Middle Ages, one of the great advances in technology, enabling the rider to stand in the saddle for stability and dexterity. Until the beginning of the 20th century, horses were a necessary fixture in the myriad quotidian patterns of everyday life in every condition. The husbanding of horses is a tradition, but it's no longer a practical one in the many ways it was until about 1900. We have planes, trains, and automobiles today to carry us and our stuff hither and thither. Mechanized vehicles plow our fields, transport our goods, and fight our battles. People still raise horses for riding and recreation, exhibition, companionship, and the joy that comes with breeding horses is a deep, profound joy. My paternal relatives have been ranchers in Montana for generations, and most of them are still passionate and devoted horse people. If you have a horse person in your life, you know who they are. Tending to horses is different in the 21st century than it was in the end of the 19th century. The tradition has changed because our way of life has changed. And a conservative understands how change facilitated by technology affects tradition. Some traditions are unrecognizable from what they were in the past. Then other traditions are immoral. Chattel slavery, as it existed in the Americas from the 16th to the 19th centuries, is a salient case of an immoral tradition. One of the many features of chattel slavery that made the institution immoral was that it necessarily predicated upon kidnapping. People were transported against their will from their ancestral lands. They were separated from their families on the slave auction block here in America, forced to work for another's profit. While chattel slavery was traditional, it has been rightly assessed as immoral and repudiated. In the United States, the repudiation of slavery was bloody, and the legacy of slavery has cast a long shadow over American history that produced another immoral tradition lasting a century after the war, the practice of separate but equal racial segregation. Race prejudice over the generations has come at a bitter cost to our people, and we're still living with its legacy. Witness the controversy surrounding Confederate memorials like A.P. Hill's. Reckoning with sin is necessary to reconciliation and atonement. So prudence. Prudence is necessary in thinking historically. We apply prudence as we critically assess the traditions that we keep and the traditions we abandon, either because they're impractical, imprudent, or immoral. Even though conservatives revere tradition as a category, they're not traditionalists in that they fight to keep all traditions intact and unchanged. Prudence points to those traditions that we ought to conserve for the sake of handing down to younger generations. And what are those? A few examples: traditions of ordered liberty, federalism, humane letters, localism, voluntary associations, respect for elders, deference to legitimate authority, freedom of religion, committed marriage between a man and a woman, and family life stabilized by the devotion of fathers and mothers in their natural roles. We embrace self-respect and respect for others expressed through wholesome manners, attention to higher purposes that go beyond one's own interest and own ambition, a love for all things beautiful, a desire for improvement in society that starts with self-examination, a circumspection that bears closely in mind the example one sets before a watching world. The employment of prudence in historical thinking searches out the difference between reverence for tradition and traditionalism. Prudence guides us in heeding the successes and the failures of the past in terms of going beyond mere fastidious concern for accuracy. Understanding, formation of the conscience, growth and maturity all stand at the center of prudence as the student of history seeks to make sense of the past for the sake of worthy living in the present and in the future. As historical thinkers, we also have the duty to extend charity to the people of the past who are now dead. It may sound strange to say that we owe the dead our love. The kind of love we owe the dead is not mere sentimental love. It's a love that moves the historian to accept the dead for who they were and to tell the truth about them. The Apostle Paul said that charity does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. If Edmund Burke was right that society is a contract between the dead, the living, and the yet to be born, then we have as much an obligation to extend charity to the dead as we do to the living and to the yet to be born. The dead are not merely abstractions or expressionless faces staring back at us from faded black and white photographs. The dead were once living, just as we are living in the present. They had struggles, failures, joys, successes, and everything in between. They raised families. They enclosed their loved ones in clay with grief, looked to the future with hope and anxiety, and wondered what the meaning of their lives might be, just like us. They had a nature just like ours. They were persons with as much dignity and as much fallibility as anyone alive today. They sinned in their acts of omission and commission, sometimes doing horrible things to each other, just as we do and we are prone to do. The study of history is humanistic in that it's concerned with real persons living in real time and real places. The extension of charity to those who cannot speak for themselves any longer, cannot take credit for their triumphs, nor answer for their mistakes and sins. And so it's eminently appropriate for those who live in the present and desire to make sense of the past to be charitable to the people of the past. One day we'll be as they are. One day we'll be all cold ashes in the grave, every one of us. What will our descendants say of us? Will they judge us by our worst moments? Will they ignore our admirable elements in our characters? Will they worship us because of our best moments, crassly whitewashing our records and thereby missing the opportunity to gain wisdom from our failures? We would hope that they would neither condemn us nor worship us, but represent us truthfully and charitably. Charity calls for a balance between valuing a life marked by dignity for what it was, while justly and circumspectly critiquing it when fallibility abounded. The extension of charity entails the restraining of perspectival power. It is neither our place to condemn the dead, nor is it our place to make gods out of them. Condemnation or idolization of the dead usually serves some purpose, but only on behalf of those in the present. A reputation gained, a book contract signed, a promotion won, or a coveted prize acquired, or an election won. Virtuous historical thinking involves the simple act of contemplating the dead for who they were, without any thought of using them for narrow political or self-centered purposes. Not so fast, the objector might say. Does not charity entail approval? If we extend charity to the dead, doesn't that mean we absolve them of their sins? Not in the slightest. The study of history helps us put away childish things. A childish mentality finds no room for compromise between two opposing positions and absolutizes issues in terms of one thing or the other. Childishness ignores complexity and will not abide paradox. In the same way one can be critically reverent of tradition, a mature person can be both charitable and critical at the same time. Charity remembers the person's dignity. Criticism exposes his fallibility. The responsible historical thinker can walk and chew gum at the same time. He can accept historical complexity and be at peace with a life or an event or an idea, representing good, bad, and everything in between. Historian Beth Barton Schweiger rightly said that we may extend charity to dead people who disturb us by learning from their mistakes, and the way this is what she said, to learn to look for logs in our own eyes. The sins of the dead reveal our sins and our blind spots if we have eyes to see them. Childishness puts personal feelings of discomfort at the forefront, seeks to cancel the dead when they push the limits of the moral imagination. But maturity learns from the dead as they really were, dignified by their humanity and yet fallen in their moral failures. Ultimately, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of people do we want to be? Do we aspire to be moral peacocks, preening ourselves and strutting about while quick to condemn others? Historian E.H. Carr wrote, "Study the historian before you study his facts." The character of the historical thinker counts towards the reliability of his conclusions. And that's true not only of others, but of ourselves as well. What defines our character as persons? We cannot claim to be persons of charity if we're not willing to extend charity to everyone, in living and dead. How we treat the dead is a reflection of how we're disposed to treat the living. If we refuse charity to the dead, how will we offer it to the living? The purpose of history is not first to change the world. From the inside out, history changes the historian first. through the exercise of restraint on the power of historical perspective and realism about human nature, which I share with everyone who has ever lived, I can have eyes to see that my problem is not out there. It's in here. I'm the problem, to quote Taylor Swift. I'm the problem. It's me. I don't have the star power as Taylor Swift, obviously. But only after accepting that realization may we be able to justify a call for change out there. Along with charity, historical thinking requires the exercise of patience. Patience teaches us to be at peace with complexity. History resists all our attempts to simplify it. It takes time and thought, careful investigation, openness to correction, and recognition of our own limited understanding to undertake responsible, virtuous historical thinking. In the same way, we ordinarily must exercise patience with our living neighbors, relatives, fellow citizens. We have the obligation to exercise patience with the dead. We must first grapple with the foreignness of the past. The deeper the past, the more foreign it appears to us living in the present. We can't gain understanding of a person who lived in the 18th century without understanding the presuppositions of the culture in which he or she lived, the knowledge that he had in the larger world, the understanding that he held of reality, his religion, his education, the technology available to him, the perspective that he had, the political scene in which he was immersed, the social realities to which he was subject. Understanding the life and times of a dead person takes an investment of time, takes respect, mental energy, takes concentration. Even after making the investment, we often come away with more questions than answers. Patience is a disposition that does not comport well with our convenience-obsessed, technology-riddled culture, or our natural fixation on being right. From our earliest experiences, we are accustomed to being resistant to the simple discipline of perseverance. Our food and drink, our technology, our transportation, our entertainment, our relationships, and a host of other things are tailor-made to meet our demands according to the timing and choose of our choosing and the comfort and safety as we understand them. Since the COVID lockdowns, practices that required some modicum of effort, such as going to church, attending a public lecture like this, going to a concert, going to a play or a movie, anything that meant getting out of the house and among other people, no longer require much in the way of submitting ourselves to processes beyond our control. We've been relieved of having to exercise patience by our technology. Artificial intelligence, we are told, will rid humanity of all forms of tedium. Patience and tedium will always be required in the pursuit of truth and understanding. Patience is a prerequisite to maturity and wholeness of a person. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge, these things don't come at the click of a mouse or the threading up of a YouTube video. Historical thinking demands patience of the person if he desires to have understanding and a formed conscience of the inner self. We have no choice, you and I have no choice, but to take the past and the people of the past on their own terms. We're not able to change past events or outcomes. As much as we would like to go back in time and kill Hitler or stop Kennedy's assassination, we're powerless to change the people of the past. And how difficult it is to change our own intellectual and emotional and spiritual, physical habits in the present. How we sometimes long to see our spouses and parents and siblings and friends and neighbors, fellow citizens, to be different than they are. I say to my child, why are you the way that you are? Just kidding, I'm not that bad. She's here somewhere, she can correct me if I'm wrong. But as difficult as it is to expect change in the thought and behavior patterns of the living, how much more ridiculous it is to demand the dead fit our present moral, intellectual, social, religious, or economic expectations. Yet we often want them to conform to our standards, rather than simply allowing them to be products of their own cultures, backgrounds, attitudes, and behaviors. We anachronistically condemn 18th century people for failing to look and act like 21st century people. Now, none of this means that we cannot think or speak critically of their lives and their actions. We don't need to be moral relativists concerning the past. But the dead really were products of their times, in the same way that you and I, in the present, are products of our times. The reality of a person being the product of their time should never justify bad actions, but rather it should explain historical context. That's what that's for. Getting down to what it meant for a person to be a product of the time is the nub of the historical issue. And it takes time, it takes thought, realism, teachability to work to understand why the dead were the way they were as we allow for moral criticisms. Finally, courage is necessary to historical thinking. Because the world of the past is so foreign to us in the present, it has the effect of making us feel very uncomfortable. Prior to the 19th century, the people of the past were accustomed to thinking that slavery was normal, that punishment for crime was meant to humiliate and set an example by gruesomeness, and that religious disagreements could be warranted for exile and tortuous execution. Do we defend the realities of those realities of the past? Do we conceal them? Do we minimize them? No! We remember that immorality is a marker of human depravity. We recoil at it because we inherently know the meaning of human dignity. Monuments and memorials, such as the one that served as A.P. Hill's grave, offered the benefit of spurring historical thinking. It's gone now, and in the case of Hill's statue, we will not have that benefit any longer. But Hill still represents in the present what Americans were in the past. And what they were has relevance for us now, regardless of our acts of willful, self-inflicted amnesia. In my years of teaching, I have found that most students are not taught in their history classes that they are supposed to be uncomfortable with the past. That's normal. To illustrate this, no one would expect a person born in Indiana to be fully at home in a place like Tehran or Pyongyang, much less London or Mexico City. Visiting a foreign country takes some courage, and similarly, encountering persons of another time takes courage. Many people respond to discomfort presented to them by the past with an immediate disposition to rid themselves of the source of the discomfort, like putting a brown bag over your head and yelling, "You can't see me." To subject oneself to amnesia takes no courage at all. It's an act of cowardice to shut one's ears to the past, to pretend it didn't happen, and remove any and all reminders of it. In the final analysis, why would people want to choose amnesia for themselves when there are more humanistic alternatives? If historical consciousness is part of what makes us human, is not the act of self-inflicted amnesia inhuman? Courage inspires us as citizens to find ways to acknowledge the features of the past that challenge our sensibilities in the present without resorting either to brute cancellation or blatant intimidation. For example, Washington and Lee University political scientist and historian Lucas Morrell spoke to the fraught issues surrounding Lee's presidency of the college after the Civil War. Washington and Lee is named for George Washington and Robert E. Lee, if you didn't know. In an interview, Morrell, who is black, said that he regarded Lee as a traitor, expressed openness to changing names of streets and place names that memorialize Confederate figures in his hometown of Lexington, Virginia. But he said he resists calls for the removal of Lee's name from the university. Rather, careful consideration and conversation are necessary during such controversies. Localities should reasonably deliberate together on the future of place names and historical monuments. Morrell's stated guiding principle on such issues is that if a monument is to come down, it ought to be for the same reasons it went up. Reasons the local community articulates and endorses. There are good reasons to dismantle monuments, But those reasons are for localities to find out through honest and historically aware deliberation. How can a civilization that chooses to rashly eradicate its collective memory expect to survive and flourish in the future? It is axiomatic that one cannot know where he is going without knowing from whence he came. In American history, there are many shameful episodes. Every idea, event, and person that material and meaningfully contributed to the development of this nation, whether they represent good, evil, or something in between, made America into the country that it is now. James Robertson pointed out, used the Confederacy as an example. Think about this. Without the rise and fall of the Confederacy, there would be no definition of American citizenship. There would be no conception of an American nationhood that embraced a plurality of people under one national purpose. There would be no aspiration of genuine racial unity. America would have lacked the unity necessary to become more than the sum of its parts if it had not had the opportunity to triumph over secession and slavery. In other words, Robertson rightly observed that the American Union of the 20th and 21st centuries would have been impossible without the existence of the Confederate States of America in the 19th century. And a civil war that produced the country we benefit from and call home today. Historical thinking that begets understanding cannot consist in accepting the dynamics that make us feel good and rejecting those things that make us feel uncomfortable. If we want to pursue truth, we must courageously face whatever discomfort we feel when confronted by a past world that is vastly different than our own and seek to understand it for the sake of benefiting from lessons learned. If we hope to survive and thrive as a nation, we must reckon with our past glories and failures procedurally, reasonably, and virtuously. If we want our children and grandchildren to enjoy the traditions of liberty and prosperity, then we must conserve tradition. We must do so circumspectly by, as Peter Furyk said, listening to the way history grows. That also requires the exercise of virtue in the cultivation of historical consciousness. To exercise virtue, we must first be people who pursue virtue. That's our calling as persons, and it's our calling as persons who identify with the Savior. Thank you very much. First, we have to ask, what is Christian nationalism? And you're not going to like the answer I'm going to give you. It's complicated. Christian nationalism in America has undergone change and evolution since the Revolution. There have been several manifestations of nationalism. I've tried to identify seven or eight in some writings that I've done. Christian nationalism is not one thing. It's a lot of things. Christian nationalism is a formation of a national identity in a particular time and place. And so in the last 50 years or so, Christian nationalism has largely been made up of people who want to say that America was founded as a Christian nation, that the founders were Christians, that Americans were Christians, that the Constitution is predicated on Christian principles. And so, Christian nationalism in our lifetimes has been oriented to the past. But someone like John Foster Dulles, who lived up to 1959, he was a Christian nationalist too. But his Christian nationalism was oriented to the future. He thought of the nation as the nation of the future. He was looking ahead. He was looking out. He was a progressive. And so, Christian nationalism can be progressive and it can also be conservative. So just to lay the basis for it. But I will say this in regard to what I talked about today with regard to historical thinking. We cannot think about Christian nationalism. We cannot think about American identity without reference to history. We're located in time, and we're located in place, and we're located in space. And any kind of statement that we make about Christian nationalism has to be a statement made with the past in mind. The past, American past, is a past of great things, great glories, great benefits to human civilization, and also great crimes against humanity. And we can go through a litany of those things, too. But we need to look at all of American history through a realistic lens. And by that, I mean these were real people that lived in real places in real times. And the great things that Americans accomplished in the past were real. And the really horrible things that Americans did against each other were also equally real. And you and I are products of all those real things, those real people, those real experiences from long ago. We are who we are because of that past. Good things, bad things, and everything in between. And so when we think virtuously, we apply the virtues like the ones I went through. We also apply other virtues like faith and hope to our understanding of our past. Because without the use of virtue, the application of virtue to try to understand who we are as Americans, we're never going to come away with wisdom. We're only going to come away with political partisanship and slashing each other with hateful words and destructive ideas.
All right, one more, and then I'm going to pass over Brandon. Considering how biased most media news sources are today, when we consider history, how can we have any confidence that the sources referencing the past are doing so with integrity? Or, you know, otherwise we'd be assuming that everybody is insincere, inaccurate, and biased. And much like today's media outlet.
That's a very, very timely question. There's so much suspicion about information out there, and I think a lot of that suspicion is rightly placed. Anybody with a computer can get on and say anything and sound like an expert, and gain a following. You know, Twitter is an amazing kind of a thing. You can have thousands of followers and be a complete dolt. You know, and just know nothing, and have a huge following of people. So, my advice to students is to give your trust to people that are worthy of trust. And in regards to the historical profession, people like Alan Gelza, who I just referenced a few minutes ago, he's a historian, great historian, written works on the Civil War and. He's a Lincoln historian. He has a new book out. I need to be like doing advertising. I need to get paid by him. I'm out here forwarding his book. New book on Lincoln. It's called Our Ancient Faith. It's a really, really just a beautiful and elegant sort of recovery of Lincoln for our own times. You know, Alan Gelzo is a really trustworthy historian. He's got a track record behind him. He obviously has demonstrated that he knows what he's talking about. Now, you might not agree with everything that Alan Gelzo says. You might not appreciate every perspective that he has, but he's trustworthy. And so finding out who the trustworthy sources are is sort of step one in kind of trying to, you know, mitigate the conspiracy theories, the bias. Everybody's going to have a bias, no matter who you're talking to. Everybody has a bias. You have a personal background. You have a ethnic background, you have a particular racial background, you have a socioeconomic background, you bring all those things to the study of history, and that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that, as long as you're aware of those things and you're honest about those things. These are some, I would say, ways I would answer that question. Yeah.
All right, name, church, right to the question.
Brandon, Only Baptist, question. Sorry, I forgot, I'm supposed to put in the blink on that one. So as you were talking about with the virtue, I believe that as Christians, we have a duty, according to the scripture, to stand bold in a culture in which, as you're talking about, is trying to tear away the history. And as believers whose sole point of belief is based upon the cross and the crucifixion of our Lord and Savior, which happened 2,000 years ago in the past, and then some odd years ago where you have people like David and all the other prophets, even, you know, thousands of years before that, right. How would you say Christians are to now look forward now to the great day in which our Savior is coming again, but still have an anchoring to the past when we look at those previous patriarchs and leaders as well.
That is a beautiful question.
Thank you. I spent a whole day thinking about it.
I love it. Man, we could talk, we could have another hour event just on that one question. As Christians, our faith is necessarily historical. So we place our faith in a historical person that walked the earth in a historical place, Galilee. It was from a real place, Nazareth, born in Bethlehem. You know, as you just indicated, all these things were prophesied in the Old Testament as well. So we have real people, we have real persons, real places, real ideas, real things happened. So our faith is based on real things that occurred in the past. So for a Christian to say, oh, I don't like history, is real strange, because your whole faith is based on past events and past person with a capital P, the Lord Jesus. It's also, being a Christian is recognizing that our faith is rooted in the past, but then having that hope for the future. Because you can't be a Christian and deny the second coming of Christ. Being a Christian means you are looking ahead to the hope of the resurrection, the hope of the return of Christ, the making of all things right in the new heaven and the new earth. And that's hope. And hope, as the author of Hebrews says, does not disappoint. This is a hope that is our anchor. It's not a sentimental, it's not a pipe dream hope, like I hope it's sunny tomorrow. It's a certain hope. It's assurance of our faith. So when Paul talks about faith and hope and love, and the greatest of these is love, those are of course the theological virtues, and these are the lenses through which we see our reality, the reality of the truths of the Bible, the reality of our historical experiences as people, as individuals, but also collectively, as a nation, as a locality. So, man, I love that question. You have to think historically in order to be a Christian. In fact, you do. If you're a Christian, you do, whether you realize it or not. Yeah.
Answer your question. Cool. My name is Jeff. I go to Redeemer Bible Fellowship Church in Audubon, Pennsylvania. There was a recent MSNBC commentary where someone said that if you believe that our rights come from God, that they are endowed by our Creator, that we are a Christian nationalist.
Right.
So,
pin that lapel pin on me. I'm a Christian nationalist then.
So, what do we make of this? Because the reality is that the difficulty in a lot of the conversation is we get labeled these terms. So I think the question is, how important is it in these dialogues to define our terms?
That's a great question. That is awesome. Okay, yeah, so that commentary, I remember that commentary a few weeks ago, that person that said that. Okay, first of all, just an ignorant statement. I mean, like, this is the Declaration of Independence. It's our founding document. It's the charter of our nation. And Thomas Jefferson wrote it, who was not a Christian at all, you know? I mean, we could just go on and on. So the ignorance and just the lack of awareness about American history and American identity is just absolutely stunning in that regard. It's also, so to get to your second main question, how important is it to us to understand these terms? Because the labels are being used. Christian nationalism, let me just sort of try to give you a map of it really fast, just very quickly. On the left, you have authors like Samuel Perry, Andrew Whitehead, Phil Gorski, Jamar Tisby, who talk about Christian nationalism, Paul Miller, talk about Christian nationalism and cast it in a certain way. Some of their ideas are actually really helpful, really quite good. Whitehead and Perry, they have sort of a self-diagnosis, like a test that you can take in the book to see if you're a Christian nationalist and how strong of a Christian nationalist you are. And the very first question of the test is, I believe that the Constitution should affirm the United States as a Christian nation. I think all of us would agree that if you believe that, you're a Christian nationalist. You know, because you want this to be a Christian nation officially in the Constitution. But then he has other things that are more unhelpful. Like if you're an inerrantist, or if you're pro-life, if you believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, then you're a Christian nationalist. No, that's not helpful. So that muddies the water. That muddies the water. So what my critique of the left's treatment of Christian nationalism is that they make Christian nationalism to be whatever they want it to be. They just define it the way they want. Now, on the far right, so Stephen Wolfe, The Case for Christian Nationalism, a book that came out maybe a year and a half ago, and then Catholic integralists like Patrick Deneen from Notre Dame wrote a book called Regime Change and Why Liberalism Failed. Okay, so on that hard right side, that what they want, they want Christian nationalism, and they define it as a monarchy. Like, Stephen Wolfe wants the king of America to be a king priest. I kid you not, if you don't believe me, read the book. It's in the book, right there in black and white. He's a king priest. He occupies the highest conceivable office, higher even than the pastor of a local church, and that he calls for an established church in America. The Catholic integralists want a monarchy, and they also want the Pope to, you know, join with the monarchy to rule the country. Now, that's like, wow, man, tell us how you really feel. That's so far outside of the American tradition as to, I mean, I'm reading Stephen Wolfe's book, and I'm on page 14, and I want to throw it across the room. Like, I can't believe the stuff that he's saying, and it's 487 pages long. And every page is something just bombastic and just crazy talk. So you've got that. What my whole point on this is to say that Christian nationalism is used in the media, used in politics, used colloquially, has no meaning. It is a meaningless statement. It is a term that is often used in order to label, you know, you and me, usually. And it's usually unfortunately, it usually emanates from the left. And that's a criticism I'll make. If you identify with the left, we can talk about that and debate that if you want. But most of the use of the term is from the left. Now, on the other hand, you know, Trump will go around and say, I'm a nationalist. And he doesn't know what he's talking about. He thinks it's just a political tactic for him. But the concept isn't going away anytime soon. And I think what we have to do is understand the historical complexities of national identity. I consider myself to be a patriot. I love this country. I think this country is the greatest country in the world. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. And I think our history is a noble history. Does that mean we're perfect? Absolutely not. We have terrible, terrible things in our history. We've done terrible, terrible things to people in the past, both at home and abroad. We are not perfect. But as I've said, a mature person can hold two things in tension: human dignity, human sin. But we can all say that we respect everybody else's humanity, even recognizing those things. And America is similar. America is our home. It's our country. We order our love for it. We don't worship it. We don't make it into a god. But we also don't want to just trash it. It's our home. It's our people. If I trash America, I'm trashing you. And that's wrong. So those are some thoughts I have with your question. I hope it's helpful.
Thank you.
Is your question a follow-up to this? If not, let me insert one that's deeper, and I want to follow up on that point that you asked. Yeah. All right, so taking that question sets us up for how can the church apply some of the virtues that you listed in relation to this conversation of national identity, or maybe even drill more specifically, how can we protect Christianity and the church from becoming just mere politics?
Yeah.
How does the church as a whole, not just me individually, how do I situate myself so that I can inhabit 2024 and not go and serve a member of the church?
Yep. All right, there's two people that got Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Who were those people? You got two. Okay, right there. Those are the chosen two.
They're going to make it out this year?
They're going to make it out.
So,
Yeah, that's right. So when you read that book, and you should all, we should all, you should all read Democracy in America, and you should all definitely get a hold of a great abridgment by John Wilsey. Actually, I don't even care if you read it. Yeah, you don't even have to read it. Just buy it. That's really all I really care. No, I'm just kidding. You should definitely read Tocqueville. Now, what Tocqueville has some really helpful things to say about this, really practical advice on that very question. Tocqueville noticed in 1835 when he came here that the pastors, the clergy in America, when they preached the faith. They preached the doctrines. They preached the Christian faith. And they didn't identify themselves with a particular political party or a particular political personality or a particular political rah-rah platform. They stuck to the task of pastoring their flock. They preached the Bible. They upheld the traditions of the church. They ministered to the people in their day-to-day life. And they didn't get involved in politics. And so as a result, the perception in the wider culture of the faith as a whole was to revere the faith. Because the clergy sort of transcended the squabbling and the constantly changing landscape of the political life of America in the 1830s. The pastors and the clergy, they sort of rose above all of that. And that's one of the things that preserved the strength and vitality of the churches and the faith in that time period, and in the North especially. Now, with regard to today, the church and Christians are so deeply engaged in politics that, you know, people on the outside of the church look, and if they don't agree with the ideology that the church associates with, then they just associate the church with that ideology. So Christianity is a Republican religion, or Christianity is a white man's religion, or Christianity is a patriarchal religion, or whatever. And Christianity simply becomes a political faith. And so in the churches, we need to not just stick to the pie in the sky type things. We need to advocate for moral causes. We need to advocate for justice in our society as informed by the scriptures, not informed by a political party and not informed by a particular political candidate. So when we read in the scriptures about the sanctity of life, we don't champion the sanctity of life because it's the Republican Party platform or because, the Supreme Court has voted a certain way. No, we hold up the sanctity of life because we believe the Bible and because we preach the Bible. We believe in human dignity because we preach the Bible. So we can advocate for causes that have a political iteration in our culture, but we do so guided by the Bible, not by the changing winds of political fortunes. One other thing I'll say about that, and that is that in the church, I think we need to resist the redefinition of our First Amendment right. Now it's fashionable to call that First Amendment right freedom of worship. Freedom of worship means that we can do whatever we want in these four walls. We can worship however we want. We can sing whatever hymns we want. We can preach, from whatever translation we want. We can have whatever, whatever food we want. We can do whatever we want in the four walls, but you better keep your mouth shut when you go out those doors. You can't speak on any public issue informed by your faith in the public square. Well, guess what? That is wrong. That is absolutely unhistorical, and it is not tradition. It is not the way that the founders or any generation of Americans that have been alive since the founding has ever understood our First Amendment right. It's not freedom of worship. It's freedom of religion. The clause in the First Amendment says that we have freedom from an established church, but we have freedom to exercise our faith, free exercise of our faith. That means in here, and it means out there. And we have to resist from the bottom up. Our churches need to resist any kind of government intrusion in our freedom of exercising our faith in the public square. Now, certainly there are reasonable things. You might, when I was on pastoral staff, we did evangelism ministry downtown, and the city asked us to get a permit to do that. It was a nominal fee. It was like $10 we had to pay to the city. And sure, we'll do that. Absolutely. We did that. We got a permit. We always carried our permit around with us when we set up a booth downtown. We had evangelism down there. And so, yeah, that's fine. We'll follow the laws. No problem. So we don't want to be unreasonable about things, but that's our constitutional right, and that's not something we should let anybody redefine or reapply in the 21st century.
Main church question.
My name's Ken. I go here to Christ Church.
Your name's Ken Huffnell.
Ken Huffnell. And I was just wondering how you would counter the Christian nationalist argument if a Christian nationalist were here, he might say...
Are you speaking for yourself or for
a
friend?
Hypothetically speaking. As a good Baptist, I mean, we believe in separation of church and state, right? But they would say things are getting so bad that Christians they might use the analogy I've heard, like, we've been in the back seat of the bus and other people have been driving the bus. It's time for us to, as Christians, try to seize the wheel, so to speak, to get our country back on track. Because things are getting to that point, like a crisis point. Yeah. Even talking about things like secession and forming a Christian republic here in the States somewhere, that we would break away from a country that they see as just utterly broken at this point. So how would you counter that?
Yeah,
those statements?
Great question. Thanks for asking that.
Would you tie that to the kind of conversations around theology as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Christian nationalist on the far right, the real Christian nationalist... like Stephen Wolf, that's really their whole reason for, you know, championing this idea, is the culture has gone so far against us. It's not the kind. I mean, we could all like tell stories about this. We don't in many ways recognize the country that maybe we grew up in, and really strange things have happened in the last 20 years, and Christians have been sort of shunted to the side more and more and marginalized more and more. And I think that's right. So what do we do? Well, I can say what we don't do. We don't repudiate the Constitution. And we don't repudiate the United States of America and try to start something over again. The really ironic thing that I find about their program on the right is that they're on the right, but they want to use the methods of the really far radical left to get their way. They want to burn it all down. They're not afraid to use violence. Stephen Wolf has a whole chapter where he justifies violent revolution. So they're not afraid to use violence. They say things like classical liberalism has had its day. American federalism has had its day. The American federal project is a failure. And they look to the future and they imagine these utopian dreams of how it's going to be when they come in charge. That's the same as Marxists. It's the same thing. It's the same thing as a neo-Marxist, as a revolutionary on the left. It's the same exact method. Christian nationalists on the right have nothing to offer. It's concrete. You ask them, well, what historical example in American history would you point to maybe to justify this or suggest that what your program is saying is reliable? And they always say the same thing. Well, we don't appeal to history. We don't do that. We appeal to logic. Well, that's what the left does. I mean, the far left looks to logical arguments. They don't ever look to concrete reality. Concrete reality is too complicated. It's too messy. And so it's much easier to craft a logical argument. So if you read Stephen Wolf's book, it's a very logical argument. The program that he proposes is deeply logical. And in fact, he says in a footnote at the beginning, if you're going to critique me, you better be logically coherent. Okay, you know, all right. Well, what I want to know is, where is the concrete examples in reality where this program has worked in the past to the benefit of the citizens, where all the citizens rise with each other, where human flourishing is actually occurring? Well, they just can't do it. So they imagine these temples in the sky in the same way that the hard left would do. So to get to your question, the answer, I think, to the situation that we're in, they want to recover something. They want to recover the theological tradition of the 17th century. I say that as Americans, We recover the American Constitution. We recover federalism. We recover tradition. Traditions that are, you know, that represent the best in the American history and also the best in human nature. As I said, we sift tradition. We don't just accept all traditions uncritically. But the tradition of federalism has yielded for us as Americans, not perfectly, never perfectly. All civilizations are flawed. But we learn from those mistakes in the past, but American federalism has yielded for us ordered liberty. Freedom is what we want. Freedom. That's what we want. And that's what we should recover. And the best way to have freedom is through American federalism, the Constitution. We know that's the best because that's what we have received and we can see in concrete reality in time. We can look at that and we can see where it failed and we can see where it went right. We can learn from the mistakes of the past and we can do the things that yielded success because we actually have something to go on. Christian nationalists on the right have nothing to go on except logical arguments and abstractions. I'm sorry, I'm not going to entrust the future of my children to abstractions, something that's never been proven. I'd much rather entrust them to a tradition that has a track record.